welcome to our next episode of the WCET Frontiers Podcast. The Frontiers Pod highlights solutions and innovations in the practice and policy of digital learning in higher education. I'm Lindsay Downs, your host for today's episode. Today, we are so excited to share my discussion with the authors of an upcoming report. Over the past year, WCET has been working on digital learning definitions, especially on the practices and the policies surrounding the different types of modalities that are used today in higher education. You can find more information about that digital learning definition work on our website, wcet.wichi.edu. And today I am talking with the authors of a brand new upcoming report about what to do when the modality of a learning experience is not clear. My guests today are Nicole Johnson, the Executive Director of the Canadian Digital Learning Research Association, and also Catherine Kerensky, the Director of Digital Learning Policy and Compliance from the WCET State Authorization Network, and Russ Poulin, the Executive Director of WCET. Hope you enjoyed this conversation. I certainly did. And make sure you stick around for the end of the episode where our guests and I share something new we've learned recently. All right. Hello, everyone. I'm here with authors who collaborated on a new paper coming out on categorizing multidimensional learning experiences. The authors are Nicole Johnson, Executive Director of the Canadian Digital Learning Research Association, who collaborated with Catherine Kerensky, the Director of Digital Learning Policy and Compliance at the State Authorization Network, and Russ Poulin, the WCET Executive Director. Welcome, Nicole, Catherine, Russ. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Great. Well, I'm so thrilled to chat about this report, the background that led to the paper, your conclusions and recommendations. So let's kick it off, get started. I think let's get at where the questions considered in the paper came from. Coming out of the pandemic, we've heard, I think, everywhere about getting back to normal, right? On campus or in the grocery store, wherever, but specifically on campus, Russ, you were seeing some pretty dramatic shifts in enrollment patterns on several campuses. What were you seeing?
Yeah, it's funny in the pandemic that we were hearing all this about people were often upset about the remote learning and what that feeling was, but then coming out of the pandemic, the students and faculty are actually, you know, voting with their actions, and that we're seeing more and more movement into either fully online courses or hybrid courses or some sort of course that uses digital technologies. And this is, you know, again, both students and faculty who are doing that. The problem is that structurally within the institutions, we haven't always dealt with how are we defining these, and what are the structures to support these? What are the policies around these? And so that's a real problem right now in terms of being clear in how we deal with and support both faculty and students.
Yeah, especially dealing with those definitions and kind of the realities of supporting those. Thank you. Nicole, you and Jeff Seaman of Bayview Analytics partnered with us, WCET, on that question about defining the different modalities for courses. What did y'all find?
Yeah, so it was about a year ago that we released that paper, and we this had started with us in on the Canadian side of things, actually. In Canada, higher education is provincially governed, not federally governed, which is an important thing to understand and how this started. And we were looking for ways to consistently track enrollments, particularly online enrollments over time. And one of the biggest barriers we were finding was differing definitions in terms of what online learning meant from institution to institution. What we did is we gathered information from Canadian institutions to find out what they were saying, and then we put together some common definitions. And that's what we put out in the paper, and we looked for agreement with those definitions that really had come from, you know, on the ground practices. And we were absolutely blown away by the findings, considering there's a long history of there being a sense of debate over how to define these terms. When we asked people who were on the ground using these words in their day-to-day language, how the extent to which they agreed with the definitions we put forth, we found incredibly strong levels of agreement. I think over 90% agreement for all but high flex, which is understandable given that's an emerging term. But it was in Canada and the US alike, there was just widespread agreement with these definitions.
Yeah, and so to be clear, yeah, we liked what they, Nicole did in Canada so well that we partnered with them so that we could do it in the US. Yeah, and the same results across both countries.
Both within each country and then across both of them.
Yeah, right. That's correct.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And we will link out to the report that we discussed in our episode notes so you guys can look into that a little bit more as well. And then Catherine, you looked at, you know, how these differences play out in federal, state, and accreditation related policies regarding the kind of more general term distance education. What did you find as agreement with within those policies?
I think a simple answer I'd say is we found no, there were a lot of different methods of defining distance education, although I think a general kind of overarching theme that was consistent that came through was that many definitions did have that explicit emphasis on the physical separation of student and instructor.
Right.
But even though many entities and organizations agreed with that theme, we really saw a lot of variation elsewhere, especially related to specificity of coursework percentages or the instruction that would constitute distance education. So for example, at one extreme, there was the in whole or in part as a distance threshold. And then at the other extreme, you could count only those courses delivered exclusively via distance education. And as you can imagine, there's a lot of examples somewhere in between with varying percentages all over. And even more interestingly, in terms of the variation and the differences, is the U.S. Department of Education, which is the federal regulator, alone has, I believe, four different definitions, three as of the time that we wrote our report, but I believe we found a fourth one. And you can see that those definitions of distance education are used for different purposes. They're used for financial aid eligibility. They're used for accreditation, and they're used for data reporting. And that's also where you see some of those thresholds ranging from the minimal one for accreditation in whole or in part to a really steep one for IPES data reporting. And then in between, you have the financial aid criteria, the regular substantive interaction measure, which requires meeting a whole host of other related criteria. But yeah, I would say there's the overarching theme of physical separation, but that's really the main agreement we saw on in policy. And I think just kind of emphasizing that point in your question that we were only looking at the term distance education. So in terms of looking at how that's applied at policy for federal accreditor or state. So I'm not sure how many additional variations you could see, including other terms like online or hybrid or high flex.
Something you could look at in the future, I guess, if you weren't busy.
Yeah.
I'm kidding. Yeah, so definitely not a lot of agreement within the different areas that especially those that have to report to different accrediting agencies or different governments, what they have to do there. Russ, I can't see this playing out very easily for staff that have to report on those numbers, but I also can't see this playing out easily with students. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, just imagine if you're a student and you're trying to navigate some of this when people are using different definitions, or they're not clear in terms of what they mean when you're trying to enroll for a course, because some institutions we heard, they would have different definitions, or we're doing different things across from one college to another. Well, if I have to enroll in courses across several colleges, now I get confused. And what happens with that? What do I do? Or the other thing we were saying is that sometimes faculty would change their mind. They would get to the course and say, oh, we're now going to meet online via Zoom on Wednesdays instead of face-to-face. And the student had thought it'd be all face-to-face, or the opposite, you know, that suddenly, oh, we're going to come in. we did a focus group with students and about this, and we had students from different parts of the U.S. and we asked them about this. And really, the bottom line was is that they really didn't care what you call what we called it, just as long as they were consistent. And the things they wanted to know were: do I have to be someplace in person, whether on campus or not? Second, if I don't have to be someplace in person, do I have to be someplace synchronously at the same time, 10 o'clock on Wednesday for a course or something? And finally, what sort of technologies do I have to use? You may want to know that at time of enrollment, because we had, it makes a big difference in terms of decision-making. And we had one student who just had to drop a class because the decision was between eating or continuing at the class, because there was all these extra technology costs involved with the change that was made. And so all of that, you know, kind of led us to what we want to talk about today is Nicole writing a paper based upon all these things we talked about. And what are the recommendations that we want to make about moving forward?
Right, right. I can't imagine, you know, I remember when I was either teaching or taking classes, and the differences in each class and the expectations just between professors and topics. But now we have, okay, online, sometimes online, not online. Where do I have to go? What do I have to do? And you want to know that from day one, so you're prepared for sure, or before day one, really. But so Nicole, you have all the answers, I'm assuming now.
I wish I had all the answers. I think after doing this, I think I have fewer answers and more, you know, but recommendations around what to do when those answers aren't clear. And I think that's probably one of the most important points to make right off the bat. And we state this in the paper, that it's unlikely that we're ever going to have universal agreement on what these terms mean. So when we're talking about this and when we're presenting these recommendations, it really comes down to that. You know, we've got institutions that have branded learning experiences based on a name that they chose, and it's tricky to, you know, change that or undo that. We have different scholarly opinions out there that, you know, can either help with clarity or add to the confusion, depending on what they're putting out there. And some people are jumping on those terms, adding new terms in there. And the crux of the paper is really to take a look at these multidimensional learning experiences, is what we call them, where it's really not quite clear what modality it is. And in the paper, we put forth three different scenarios, three different cases that I crafted based on real life situations that I've heard from people in the field. I've talked to, I think, over the past going on 3 years now that I've been working in this, hundreds of people in Canada and the US in a whole variety of different positions, from faculty to registrars to administrators to teaching and learning leaders. And, you know, there's so many nuances and complexities that happen in this work. It's not just as easy as saying, we are going to call this experience online learning. So when we get into the paper and we're looking at those complex situations, the key things that I'm putting forward in this is the notion of having a good enough consensus. So we may not have that universal agreement, but perhaps we can get to the point where we say, okay, if a learning experience is happening entirely online, whether it's synchronous or asynchronous or a mix of the two, but there's no in-person requirement, we can call that online learning. The importance of, you know, of kind of playing in those blurred lines, we talk about not becoming overly granular with how we name things. And I think that sort of has been coming out in a few papers that I've read, even recently, you know, with new names coming out to describe things. I think one of the new names that came out is bi-chronos or bi-synchronous. And I who study this, had trouble with that, going, what does that mean? So I understand the reasoning behind creating those words, but I think we need to be careful not to add more confusion into an already complex space, and not creating situations where institutions have so many names for different learning experiences that nobody can remember what's what. And one of the interesting points that was made, I believe, when we were chatting at the most recent WCET steering committee, which I was invited to, was the idea that we can potentially box faculty in and not give them enough leeway to try new ways of teaching and learning if we are so prescriptive that, you know, this exact modality with these specifics, we're going to call this this, and you can't veer out of these lines in any way. That can cause real issues and problems. The next thing was the importance of a student-centered approach, and we really take that approach. And I think that speaks to, you know, really giving careful consideration if we're going to add complex new names to things. Are the students going to understand what that name means? Russ made an excellent point about cross-institutional definitions. So if a student is taking, you know, courses at different institutions, or they're transferring from one institution to the next, are they going to understand what terms mean when they, you know, do the terms mean the same thing from one institution to another? And do the students know what they're signing up for? Like, you know, by just looking at the name and not having to memorize what a complex name means, but just by, you know, looking and saying, okay, that's an online learning experience. I know that that means I don't have to go into campus, but I better read the description to see if I have to attend Zoom meetings on certain days. And I know that that means that I have to have, you know, reliable internet access, and I have to have a device that's going to be capable of this. I think the problem is when we get courses that are pitched as in person, and then a person, like Russ said, that student who had to choose between, you know, whether they learned or whether they ate, because there's all of a sudden these technology requirements that they didn't sign up for. So those are just, that's just the tip of the iceberg, I think, in terms of what the paper talks about. But we really go deep into these areas where there isn't a clear and easy answer.
And if I may, Nicole, that some of the things I think that you're hitting there at the end is that sometimes people use words that we think everybody understands, like fully online. We're hearing that. They say fully online. Well, you put that name on the front, but yet it's not fully online. It's you have to come to campus, you know? Or somebody was saying in person, and they thought, well, in person meant that, well, we're all on Zoom, so we're in person. I said, well, you know, very few people think of that. But you were making a really good point too about the not boxing faculty in. Could you talk about that? You know, you have that spectrum that you work on. That you helped to create, and that would be helpful to talk about.
Yeah, for sure. So the modes of learning spectrum, and that's in the paper that I believe, Lindsay, you're linking to this. And so I won't over explain that, but it really just puts things in, you know, an easy spectrum from, you know, in-person learning with absolutely no technology requirements at the bottom, to in-person learning with technology integration, then to hybrid learning, and inside these, you know, categories, we have a whole bunch of variations. So when I say hybrid learning, in that category are things like flipped learning. You may have an online learning experience with an in-person practicum or an in-person intensive. So it's a catch-all term for really any learning experience that could be a mix of in-person and online. We go to online learning. And again, that could be asynchronous, synchronous, a mix of the two. Those all fall into the, you know, that big bucket of online learning. And then we have, you know, this at a distance learning, similar to correspondence learning, which would be totally at a distance, but no technology requirements. And both extreme ends of the spectrum with no technology requirements would be very rare in this day and age. I think, Russ, when we have that, when a course is categorized in these very, very specific ways, so that it must only, you know, it's online and, you know, it's, but it must be taught according to these specific parameters, based on this, you know, this naming convention that has come out, and that means specifically this with no room for anything else. It really limits teachers in what they're able to do and to be able to read the classroom needs. Synchronous learning is a tough one too, because a lot of people are with a synchronous online experience. Those types of online learning experiences typically have a heavy asynchronous component as well. You're not going to have the only learning that takes place in a synchronous course be just your classroom sessions. You are probably going to be accessing digital materials through a learning management system, and there's going to be a whole lot of experiences in there. So, but if we're saying that, you know, all the teaching has to be done in this certain way to meet this category, and if we've got this other totally separate category to capture, you know, a mix of asynchronous and synchronous learning versus a synchronous learning, you know, experience, all of a sudden a faculty is, you know, faced with extra dilemmas that they don't need, going, oh, am I crossing this line into this different modality? And it was listed like this, versus just being able to say, you know, online learning, and having in the course description, there will be some synchronous requirements, because that's important to for students to know that, oh, I can complete this, whether, you know, I can complete this at my own pace over the course of a semester, or, you know, at my own pace, but with regards to these, you know, milestone deadlines in the semester, versus I can, you know, I have to attend, you know, every Wednesday at 2 p.m. I have to be online in this classroom. So I think limiting faculty that, and that also limits what sort of technologies they can employ and how they teach. Another good example would be, you know, in-person learning, without specifying that there might be technology requirements, that students might need to watch videos posted in the learning management system, and they might be expected to submit their assignments in that way. And that's fine. I don't want to say that I'm discouraging technology in any way, because I'm absolutely not. I'm a strong advocate for it, but equally so, students need to know what that means, more so than, you know, coming up with these terms to capture every possible variation of what might happen. Does that elaborate that on that well, Russ? Did I capture that point?
Yeah, I think you did. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked about that, Russ. I thought that was a really interesting, especially the way you phrased it about kind of the boxing the faculty or boxing the course in. That's a really huge point. Okay, so Nicole, what are the recommendations that you include in the paper?
Yeah, so I'll just give a brief overview, and they're more detailed in the paper, but really it comes down to those key points that I was talking about, you know, that student-centered approach in particular, and that good enough consensus. So most importantly, and this is particularly links to what Catherine was saying, is it's critical to determine any policy, funding, or reporting requirements that might be in place. Because if we're categorizing a learning experience as one thing, and it's being delivered in a different way, and that could impact whether a student is receiving funding, those are just really, really critical pieces. So you want to make sure the experience matches the definition that's required by policy. And that, I know, causes issues, because sometimes, you know, an internal definition, or, you know, what we would want to call it, would fit better, but we really do need to be mindful of those policy requirements. And then it's what I talked about, you know, what are the requirements for students? Ooh, you know, does that impact the modality? You know, will they need to travel to campus? Are they able to successfully complete the course if they don't have a, you know, broadband internet or a personal device? And we've, you know, got that modes of learning spectrum. And really the purpose of that is to act as a guide to decide which modality is the closest fit, even if it's not the perfect fit. And so, you know, we understand that people saying, well, you know, not all experiences would fit into this. It's like, yeah, no, they probably went, especially as more emerging experiences come forth. But where's the closest fit? And, you know, what aspects of the experience, if it does straddle the line, what aspects of the experience, you know, are more, you know, say, for example, the line between in-person and hybrid learning, what aspects of it are more hybrid, what aspects of it are more in-person. And then, you know, going back and looking again at those policy requirements. So now we've got it, you know, fitting on the spectrum. Does it actually need to be modified in some way so that it still meets policy requirements? And then one of the most important recommendations is deciding how this course will be described to students. Simple, plain language is always best. You know, does it have a clear name that captures the modality of the course? And is it informational to students? So when students are looking, you know, to register for their course, they easily understand what they're signing up for. And with these things all in mind, that's when it's, you know, determine the overall modality name for that type of a course and determine how it will be coded. And again, just if you're creating a new modality name, ask, is that going to be contributing to over granularity and confusion? And just trying to pick broad names to, again, to allow for that faculty to have wiggle room to create easy student understanding. I don't think that we need overly specific names for every single possible type of variation of online and hybrid learning. I do think that that creates more confusion when we're trying to come up with clarity.
I kind of call out the exceptions to the buckets that you had there for those definitions. I like that. That seems like that would help you easily understand what you're in for as a student, but then understand what you need to plan for that's different. Wonderful. Well, thank you for going over those recommendations for us. And I'm sure everybody is thrilled to read the paper and look into those for themselves. So what's next? We're doing some additional work in the modalities and definitions in digital learning arena. Catherine, what are we looking into?
Yeah, I'm happy to talk about that. So in the policy paper report that I wrote in conjunction with Russ, where we analyzed those policy definitions, we identified future areas for research to be, especially into institutional implementation. So we recently conducted a survey, actually closed at the end of July, on those institutional definitions. So we surveyed institutions on whether they had official definitions of, you know, common digital learning terms, such as distance learning, hybrid, high flex, et cetera, and really trying to see what work is being done in terms of having those kinds of definitions at institutions. And then importantly, also how what they were influenced by in terms of coming up with those definitions and how they are communicated and how they impact students. So we're in the midst of reviewing that. I think we've already seen some interesting results. And I'd say look forward to a report to be released later this fall with those results and some of the common themes and, you know, any unique things that we point out there. But we're really hoping to take these and further on and develop some good practices going forward that we hope will help institutions that are still either coming up with these definitions or, you know, refining them, improving them, however it might be needed. So looking forward to doing that over the next few months.
Great. Nicole, Russ, want to mention anything that's coming up for you in these topic areas? I know, Russ, you're working with Catherine on that as well.
Yeah, I am, Annette, and then Catherine will be hosting a session at the WCT annual meeting where it'll be an open discussion where we'll go through some of the results of those surveys, and then we'll want to hear, does this resonate with you? And we want to have a really good discussion there about and learn from the members about what are they saying around these issues.
Yeah, for me, I'm just continuing to engage with organizations and with institutions on this work, particularly, you know, as institutions or, you know, organizations in Canada, government agencies are looking to create policies around this and create new names. Again, that refining names, figuring out how do we proceed now that, you know, online and hybrid learning really are expected to grow and continue to grow for the next while. So that's where a lot of my work lies right now.
Oh, great. That hopefully can help everybody have a little bit more clarity there. Great. Well, is there anything else you guys wanted to add about this upcoming paper or thoughts on the recommendations or anything?
I think we're good.
Cool. Well, we'll be releasing that paper that Nicole collaborated with WCT on here shortly this fall, and then we'll be looking forward also to releasing that additional research report that Catherine discussed too. So one thing I always ask my guests at the end of our episodes is, what is something new that you have learned or are learning? And so this can be personal or professional. For example, one of my previous guests talked about learning ice fishing. I hope he's still doing it this winter because it sounded really, really great. And I will go first so that I kind of take the plunge first. But so my thing that I'm learning is that I've been taking some online tutorials and things to do animated videos. So, and I hopefully my team knows that that could be used for interesting WCET looking videos with fun animations and little characters. So that's what I'm learning right now. Anyone else want to share something new they've learned?
I could go. I had the pleasure of being at a conference where I saw the celebrity chef Jose Andreas earlier this year. And I read his book, We Fed an Island. This is about the efforts that he did in terms of feeding the Puerto Ricans after the terrible hurricanes that were there. And the thing that I really learned from it, and was sort of inspired by it, I work so much in the definitions and in the policy things and about, you know, how do you do things by the rules and all this sort of thing. And he was very much all about how do we do what needs to be done regardless of what the rules are. So he would just think differently, bring people together and make it happen. And then they started having, okay, let's make 500 meals a day. Let's make 1,000 meals a day, you know, and get up, let's make 20,000 meals a day. Very inspiring, very interesting in terms of the creativity and thought in terms of bringing people together to make something happen when there is a need.
Yeah, wow. Thank you for sharing. That's really cool. I'll have to look into that book too. Catherine, Nicole?
I can go.
Thank you.
One thing I was thinking of, so I read books to my son regularly, and one that he's been wanting read recently, he's three, it's like this little kid's first book from National Geographic, and it's on rocks, minerals, and shells. And I feel like on some level I probably knew this before, but it clicked to me all of a sudden in terms of like that shells are always like essentially the like skeleton or the former home of a sea animal. And like I just never really thought of it in that way. Obviously I knew some animals were, you know, lived in shells and whatnot, but it didn't occur to me that like every shell you see on the beach was basically that. So it was just an interesting thing that I thought of, especially being like, you know, I just learned this from reading my son's book. So, and just kind of confirmed it. Like I said, I feel like I probably knew it on some level, but it was just kind of a revelation, that I had that I was maybe reminded of. Just an interesting thought. We like sea animals. We like going to the beach. So
that is an interesting thought. And I think maybe it brings to mind for me just the amount of the sea animals and their former homes in the seashells. Cause every time I go to the beach, I'm just astounded by how many seashells there are. And well, it's a big deal when I go to the beach because Montana doesn't have very many. So, oh, great. Catherine, I also learned from reading to my kids. So I enjoy that. Nicole.
Yeah. So the one thing I learned is So every summer, my kids and I, we go to a summer camp that puts on a family camp. So it's one of the highlights of my summer for years, and the kids just love it too. But this year, like for the, you know, they do a part where the kids are doing things where they have like adult activities, and they had like arts and crafts, but for adults. And they brought in someone who did soapstone carvings and taught us how to do soapstone carvings. So that was really fun. I got to spend a few hours just, you know, I always forget in, you know, this digital world, how nice it is just to be completely disconnected, chatting with people while you're doing something with your hands. So I wouldn't say I'm any good at it, but I thoroughly enjoyed it. And yeah, just learning how to do something that's a little bit more, you know, on the crafty side of things, when so much of my days are focused on, you know, cognitive and heavy tasks. It was a really fun experience.
I love that. And it gave you time to kind of socialize with the other adults at the camp. And oh, that's pretty cool. I'll have to look at soapstone carvings. That's neat. I've never heard of those. Heard of soapstone counters, but not carvings. That's cool. Well, thank you everyone for sharing the things that you've learned recently. I always just enjoy sending that question out and hopefully not springing it onto people too quickly, and hearing what we've all learned recently, because it's always important to just keep on learning new things every day. So, hey, Catherine, Russ, Nicole, it was absolutely wonderful having this conversation with you. And I am just thrilled to see all these publications and learn more about the work coming up in the next few months. Maybe we'll have you back.
I'd love that. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you guys. Yeah.